If you've ever in Britain and get into the countryside amongst the hedgerows and bluebells, you'll come across brigades of walkers wandering across farmlands, hill and dale, moor and heath. The Brits call it rambling. And right around the old Dart, there are thousands of ramblers who each Sunday pull on their walking boots, raincoats, and I'm reliably informed chomp on something called Kendall mint cake to spend a day walking across the land. But it's one thing to trot across the Ilkley Moor, stopping for a cool ale or, dare I say it, a shandy at the local pub, all very wholesome. It's quite another to ramble along the imposing concrete barrier that now divides the West Bank and Israel. In 2010, British comedian, investigative journalist and all-round agitator Mark Thomas did just that, and he takes the stage with his story at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, which kicks off tomorrow in Melbourne. It's a show that's seen him nominated for the Amnesty Freedom of Expression Award. I think it's the first comedy act to be nominated. Welcome to Australia and to Radio National, Mark.
Hello, and lovely to be here.
Oh, good. Good to have you.
Listen, I was just thrilled with listening to your debate and discussion earlier. I just think it's fantastic that a radio station can call local councillors behaving like the Taliban. It makes my day.
I didn't say it, they did.
I know, but it just makes my day. And what a great, sensible, proper discussion. That was wonderful.
Look, you call the show extreme rambling, but are you a rambler in the traditional sense, Mark?
Do you mean, do I waffle on?
No, ramble, as in walk, as in trot across the countryside,
oh, okay.
Man.
because obviously there's a double meaning here, rambling as in just continually talking. And yes, I do ramble on the countryside. And I dearly love it, actually. I really, really like doing it. And there was a weird thing when I started doing it, because obviously I take my family out across the countryside. When I first come up with the idea of walking along the length of the wall and using the wall as the route map, people were asking, why are you using the wall as your map? And my wife answered, it's because he can't map read.
Yeah.
It's because you can't actually, if you've got a great wall, you can't get lost.
She would say that. So I have to then ask the obvious question, why walk the barrier? What drew you to walk it? We were talking, I mean, at the time, I think it was 400 kilometres of concrete wall, a site of, you know, tremendous political and cultural division.
Well, actually, I should explain, it's not quite that, it's not, the concrete is only 5% of the wall. The rest of it is a military barrier of ditches and electronic fences, motion detectors, army patrols, barbed wire and all that kind of stuff. Mm. And it'll be, when it's finished, it's going to be 723 kilometres long. And what made me do it? To this day, I don't quite know. I'm still trying to work it out. That part of it is mischief. Part of it is, I'd say in the show that part of the reason that I wanted to walk it is because all military barriers, whether it's the Great Wall of China, you know, whether it's the Berlin Wall, they're destined to become tourist trails at some point in the future.
Yeah, that's so true. I've got a little bit of the Berlin Wall.
I have too. It's turned up all across
the world. It's crazy, isn't it? But you also wanted to do for rambling what Hunter S. Thompson did for journalism.
Yes, I wanted to have gonzo rambling. That's entirely right. That there would be a degree of improvising that would go on. It would go a little bit jazz. And I think that's an appropriate way of doing it.
You've got go on.
Because the thing about it is when you start, I should explain, I walked on both sides of the wall and you have to have translators with you. And so you have to try and work out which bit of wall you're going to walk along, where the checkpoints are, do you want to cross, will you be able to get across, what time your translators should meet you with, you know. So there's a whole load of logistical problems that you have to meet. And so it just ends up becoming slightly chaotic no matter what you do. The place has got this sort of chaos factor. And so no matter what I did, there was going to be a Hunter S. Thompson element to the ramble.
When you arrived, was it an intimidating scene? remind people that you actually are, I don't think you can be intimidated, the sort of stuff you've done over the years.
Well, was it intimidating? The first day I arrived was absolutely nuts. Because I woke up in the morning in the middle of East Jerusalem, my first time in the West Bank, and I've got this fixer who phoned me and just went, you're going to go downstairs. Go downstairs now. We're going to get you a car. And so I literally grabbed my gear, went downstairs. There's a driver. He said, I am your driver. Let me take you. And he drove me out along to this wall and said, there's a Jeep behind us. They're flashing us. I'm going to stop. You're going to get in there. And this, so I just got out of this car in the middle of nowhere next to this wall. The Jeep pulls up. This guy is sitting there. I get in the car and he goes, I am a lawyer. Let me take you around the settlement. And this complete stranger drove me off around these settlements to explain what's going on. And this all happened on the first day. You know, this is the first thing in the morning. I end up talking to human rights groups and then going to meet... I met a whole range of people on the very first day. And I was sitting there. The UN led me to this area where... Israeli settlers are forcing Palestinians out of their homes so they can take them over, and they're turning the area into a settler area. And you know, really, Palestinians refer to it as ethnic cleansing, and it's really hard. And the families were sitting opposite their homes. They sit outside the homes they've been kicked out of, and they sit in tents. And I went and talked to the families, and this is all on the first day. This is all happening on the first day. And I went up to speak to the families and said, have the police done anything? And they said, yes, they've moved this on for having an illegal structure because they'd been arrested for illegally putting up a tent. And I was thinking, whoa, this is nuts. I was having some kind of culture shock. And I remember this UN chap goes, come on, let me take you for a dinner. And he took me into this restaurant. I was just sitting down. And Tony Blair walked into the restaurant. And
how bizarre.
I was just like, this is the man I've tried to actually get in court for war crimes. And I'm sitting thinking, oh, my Lord. So that was, it was fairly intense.
You had plenty of encounters with Israeli soldiers along the way and Israelis, citizens.
Yes.
What sort of encounters?
Well, some of them were very pleasant. You know, the weird thing is when you know, the soldiers... range in attitude to you all the time. They have an incredible amount of authority, individual authority, and they can make the law up as they go along, really. And so, I mean, we got detained on our first day and were stopped for having a camera. Once, on one occasion, I was stopped for walking too close to the wall. And when I said to the soldier, how close should I be? How can I walk? He said, you should walk 300 metres away. I said, but that's off the edge of a cliff. He said, okay, 150. And then on another occasion, we're walking past a checkpoint and the soldiers must have heard me talking and heard my accent.
That Cockney
soldier,
accent.
He suddenly goes, oi, mate! Where are you from? And I was like, what? He said, I'm from North London. Hey, Arsenal. And he starts singing football songs at me. And I'm just thinking, this is the most bizarre situation, you know. And it is, I mean, it's very different for me, though, because as an Englishman walking along, I can either be a journalist or I can be a comic or I can be a writer. I can be a travel writer. I can be working with the international brigades. I can be doing a whole range of things. I can move and change my identity.
Which you do. People. That's the nature of you, the way you do your comedy, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I can change, you know, how I relate to authority. But Palestinians really haven't got much of an option.
Did the locals view you as a bit sort of, this was a Brit on a bit of a suicide mission? Because I gather you were tear gassed.
No, I
you
think
were
suicide
stoned.
Missions are taken very literally over there.
True.
So, you know, that's not... no, they were very intrigued. They didn't quite get the hang of rambling at all. They didn't quite get the... I remember this bloke who was supposed to help us, and it was just one of these nutty things. I woke up and he wasn't where he was supposed to be when we were supposed to meet him. And so I phoned him and he said, you are rambling? I said, yes. He said, it is raining. I said, yeah, well, that's what we do. That's what British people do. When it rains, we go walking.
Yes,
that's
nuts.
What happens. When it snows, we climb mountains and wait to be rescued. That's what we do. And so they didn't quite understand the nature of the ramble.
In the first week, you visited the Freedom Theatre in a refugee camp.
That's amazing.
This
That's
is an extraordinary outfit,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Oh, this is absolutely brilliant. The Freedom Theatre is, do you know, they were the first people to get what we were doing. Right, it's a theatre in a refugee camp in Jenin on the Palestinian side. And it's a very conservative area, is a refugee camp, and these people internally displaced. Okay, so I go to meet this guy. And he said, who runs the theatre? And I said, he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm walking along the length of the barrier, talking to people, trying to understand a bit about the conflict. And he just went, oh, we were going to do that. That was going to be our project. And then he called to his mate from an edit suite and goes, guess what he's doing? He's walking along, and this bloke went, oh, well, that's our project gone. And so they were the first people to understand what I was doing. The guy who used to run the place was a wonderful bloke called Giuliano Mechemith, and he was half Israeli, half Palestinian. And when I met him, his whole attitude was, we are raising the next generation of freedom fighters in Palestine, but they're going to be non-violent, and they're going to be critical, and they're going to be critical of Palestinians as well as Israelis instead of just waving flags. And to prove a point, his first production that they put on at this theatre was Animal Farm by George Orwell.
Oh, wow.
And the Palestinian National Authority went up the wall about it. Unfortunately, there was one nearby for them to just do that. So they were really, you know, furious about it. And someone tried to firebomb the theatre. The second production they put on was about a martyr who refused to stay dead because he realised he'd made a mistake.
Oh, God.
So it's really
working
all
with
the taboos.
Kids, aren't they? They're working with
young
people.
Yeah, these incredible young people, though. I mean, they have three women on the course, which is remarkable. Right? For a very conservative refugee camp, it's remarkable. And one of the women... one of the families in the camps put round leaflets saying she was a slut because she dared to do drama. Mm. And her family used to walk her into the drama school each day to make sure she got there. They had gang leaders in the camps who now do drama. They had one bloke who, I promise you, apropos of nothing, came up to me and just said, I saw you the other day and I want you to know I am now doing this drama course. And before I started this drama course, one of my options was to be a suicide bomber.
Aye.
And now I know that art is my weapon. And you just go, whoa.
That brings
and this
it
happens,
home.
This is everyday sort of encounters. Mm. And it was quite the most remarkable place. And we stayed there, me and my cameraman and mate who walked the length of the wall. We stayed at the theatre. They put us up. And it was just every day we'd leave and these students would make us tea and say, have a good walk. And we'd come back and these drama students would be like, how did it go? You know. And it's a remarkable place. And unfortunately,
there's
the guy
a very
who
sad postscript to this, isn't it?
Yeah, he was killed. He was murdered by a Palestinian.
Ironically.
Outside the theatre. And, well, this is, yes. And, of course, it goes into meltdown because suddenly the Israelis are going, ugh, who cares? You know, that's what happens when you work with them. And then the Palestinians are going, no, it wasn't us. It was the Israelis. It was a plot. And, actually, what they were doing was incredible work.
There are people living their lives just trying to get through on both sides of that wall. Ooh. And you met them along the way. How did you engage with the politics of the situation with people?
Well, people just start talking to you. That's the great thing. Mates of mine said to me before I went out, look, you won't have trouble speaking to you. You know, people coming up and speaking. What you'll have is getting them to shut up.
What did they talk about?
That's the problem.
I mean,
everything.
From every side.
Well, it's very funny. We used to, because on the Palestinian side, there is an Arabic sort of culture of just hospitality that is, it's a real pain. I mean, you know, not to be rude about it, but every single day we would be stopped and complete strangers
and fed,
trying to force tea and coffee. Yeah, no, seriously.
Poor man.
No, but I mean, we were trying to walk from A to B and people go, no, come, you must have tea with me. You must meet my family. You must stay for dinner. And like every day, it was like being mugged by a cake trolley. It was just nuts. It got to the point, I promise you, I put on weight on the walk. Right, because of people just stopping. And when I got home, my wife was just like, well, where have you been?
You lard us. Yes.
Exactly.
She'd been rambling across the English countryside, losing weight, and
then
you've been packing it on.
And it's kind of like, well, who have you been seeing? You know, it's that kind of thing.
What about Israeli citizens? Who did you talk to?
Well, on the Israeli side, you meet a whole range of folk. Lots of soldiers and lots of settlers. And the settlers are very, very different. You know, it would be very, very foolish and probably racist to describe them just as one homogenous lump. Because actually, you know, you get economic settlers who are there because it's cheap, and you get ideological settlers. You get people who are saying, yes, I want to live here, but, you know, if there was a land for peace deal, I'd go and we could shut this place down. That you get all sorts of different folk there. I should say, the hardcore settlers are nuts.
Why?
I mean, just because I spoke to one guy and said, look, he hates the wall, by the way. There are lots of Israelis who have different attitudes towards the wall. A lot of people believe that the wall represents a new barrier, a boundary. So this is where Israel stops expanding. And actually, there are settlers who believe that all of the West Bank belongs to Israel. And one guy I was speaking to, and I said, well, where do you want to build through? And
so he said, they feel contained, not protected.
Yes, absolutely. They feel, so there are Israeli settlers who are going, it's thwarted their national plans. And yes, they do feel contained. And one guy was saying, where's the boundary? Where's Israel's boundary? And he said, the Hadeken. He said, I want to build from here to the Hadeken. And I said, the Hadeken? He said, yes, the Hadeken. And I said, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's the Euphrates. He said, yes. I said, in Iraq? He said, yes. Mm. I said, you want to build from East Jerusalem all the way through to Iraq and make it Israel? Yes. So there are, you know, there. I did say good luck with that.
How do you view the wall? Because it's a hard one to reconcile that we spent generations dismantling the Berlin Wall. People are still recovering from that division. And here we are with another wall going up, which will take generations potentially to dismantle yet again. So history repeats itself in our lifetime.
Yes and no. Yes and no. Any wall is an admission of failure. I mean, it's the political process has just failed, and that's what a wall is, any wall like that. But the walls are kind of, it's a servant of many masters. And, you know, the Second Intifada, which was a campaign that was really marked by the suicide bomb attacks, and there were hundreds. And actually, in one month alone, I think it was 156 Israelis died in suicide bomb attacks. So the impact is enormous. And what the wall was put up for, the public clamour to put this wall up to stop the suicide bombs.
Mm.
Once the politicians make that decision to put the wall up, then the wall becomes ultra-political. Where does it go round? What land does it take? Settlements on the West Bank are suddenly going, well, we want to be on the Israeli side of the wall. So the wall has to cut into the West Bank and go round us, so we're included. Then other people are saying, actually, there are water rights and issues that we need to take into consideration. Other people say, well, look, there's a bit here. We want East Jerusalem to remain Jewish. So what we're going to do is we're going to extend areas out to make sure it's separated from the West Bank. And so you get these areas, you get all sorts of different political motives for where the route of the wall goes.
It's an incredible story that you're going to tell on the stage at the Melbourne Comedy Festival. And I have to say, I mean, this is your thing, unravelling the politics, making meaning of politics, exposing human rights abuses. You've taken on the arms trade over much of your career as a comedian. But politics can be a massive turn-off for folk as well. So how do you walk that fine line, Mark Thomas, between preaching kind of polemics and observational comedy, as you call it?
Well, it's observational comedy. It is observational comedy, because if you're going to do observational comedy, a lot of people do that, and they do it very well, and it's very good. And it's about the things that unite us. And I just like looking at things that we might not know about. And it's not a polemic, in a way. It's actually about, it's me discovering things. And that's the way that you do it, is you get up. Somebody was asking me the other day, you know, how do you make this funny? And I said, well, when you're with a group of mime artists and you get tear gassed by the Israeli army and they decide to stay in character, the script kind of writes itself.
Absolutely. Hey, Mark Thomas, thanks so much for joining us on Life Matters on Radio National.
That's a real pleasure.
Have a great show. I think
you'll have a ball.
Comedians always come back to the Melbourne Comedy Festival once they've done it once.
Well, I've done a couple of the club nights already. We're just doing some other bits and pieces to warm up for the gala show, and it's a really great place.
Enjoy.
Really good fun.
Enjoy.
Thank you.
And Mark Thomas, British comedian and, investigative journalist, really. He's hosted radio shows and TV shows on Channel 4 and The Beeb over there. And the Melbourne Comedy Festival runs from March the 29th to April the 22nd. We'll link to it on the Radio National website.